Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday, April 8th. Sunshine and 21 degrees here in Old Town and 25 degrees and sunny in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Gieboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Monday to you, and also happy Eclipse Day. We're not going to see totality here in Utah, but we'll see roughly 40 to 60% coverage. And in Park City, that main eclipse time, or the maximum that we're going to see, roughly 50% coverage will be around 12:30 this afternoon. So if anybody looks up, sees a partial eclipse, will be something cool to look at. Just remember, have the proper eye protection if you do plan on looking at the sun. And hopefully the clouds don't get in the way, because today we'll bring a mix of sun and clouds across the Wasatch back with only a slight chance of seeing a stray shower or two, with maybe about a 10 to 20% chance at most. Otherwise, it's going to be a cool day. It just won't be as chilly compared to what we saw over the weekend. We'll see roughly a daytime high of 40 degrees in Park City, and we'll get into the mid and upper 40s down in the Heber Valley, which is good for about 5 to 10 degrees below our seasonal averages, but again, warmer compared to what we saw over the weekend. And then by tonight, we're back to mostly clear skies with the overnight low falling to 22 degrees. And once we get past today, high pressure will build in and it will stay established across the Beehive State more or less through this week. And that's going to allow our spring feeling to crank up each day. Starting today through the rest of this week will be warmer than the last. We'll come in with a daytime high of 46 on Tuesday, mostly sunny skies, dropping to 28 degrees on Tuesday night, mostly clear. Then we're around 50 degrees on Wednesday, still keeping the sunshine around, and we'll drop to an overnight low of 30 degrees on Wednesday night. And by Thursday, we'll be pushing mid to upper 50s in Park City with a daytime high of 57, and we'll only drop to 38 degrees on Thursday night under mostly clear skies. And on Friday, there is a chance that we could see a daytime high climb into the low 60s in Park City. So if you are not a fan of the cooler weather that we've seen over the last few days, you don't have to wait too long for it to really feel like spring across the Wasatch back. But of course, as we go throughout this time of year, it's only a matter of time before we see some changes. And it looks like those changes will arrive this weekend. Forecast models are split just on how strong the system that we're going to see this weekend will be, but it looks like we at least see a cool down with a chance for a few showers. On Saturday, we'll see a chance of rain and snow with a daytime high of 58, dropping into the upper 30s on Saturday night. And then we'll also look at a chance of rain, snow, showers on Sunday with a daytime high coming in at 52. So it looks like temperatures will ease back down from the weekend into early next week, slightly unsettled, but through the rest of this week after today, we'll be looking at mostly sunny skies and a full-on spring feeling, especially by the back half of this work week, Leslie.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Thomas.
You're welcome.
And on the phone with a look in the backcountry, forecaster Drew Hardesty. Good morning, Drew.
Leslie, having the backcountry riding and skiing really well right now. Just nice, amazing spring storm, 16 to 24 inches over the weekend, and remarkably well-behaved. We didn't really hear of any significant avalanches from the backcountry ski area control teams. Did trigger, I would call them garden variety soft slabs and loose snow avalanches, primarily along the upper elevation bands. Today we started at low, except for the upper elevation bands, where just isolated pockets of wind slabs may still be triggered, again in the upper elevations, most likely on north to east to south facing aspects. I think that the stability trend is would be on the uptick, and most of those would have settled out by the afternoon, but that should be on the radar for folks heading into the high country this morning. The wild card will be the cloud cover. And so I think with still relatively cool temperatures out there and intermittent cloud cover, it's hard to discount the high, strong April sun. So I just am imagining that the wet avalanches will not get out of control, but I'll just say rising to moderate on all the steep solar aspects east, south and west for wet avalanches today. So yeah, you got to be your own forecaster, just sort of see how the snow is reacting to the sun on your feet today and adjust accordingly.
Okay, and I think you have some good news to report. A replacement has been found.
Yeah, the Forest Service has hired a new director for the Avalanche Center. Our current director, Mark Staples, is returning back to his roots up in Bozeman. And so we have hired Paige Pagnuco, who is so great. She's been with us quite a long time, and she cut her teeth. She and her husband, Toby Weed, cut their teeth as patrollers at Park City Mountain Resort way back in the day, and they have been our avalanche forecasters up in Logan for on towards 20 years. And Paige brings so much experience and professionalism, and what a great leader. We're really going to be happy to have her come in and take the reins, and that's just a big win for us at the Utah Avalanche Center.
Yeah. Does she have an official start date, or?
I think it's May 5th, May 7th. She's going to take a couple weeks of well-deserved rest and vacation before she kicks it into high speed for, as always, a very busy season for the director in the summer. So I think May 5th or the 7th.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me, I mean, what's the difference, though? I mean, she's an employee of the National Forest Service. Chad Brackelsberg is also director of the Utah Avalanche Center. How is this different?
Leslie, great question. I mean, it's such a unique partnership between the nonprofit, the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center. Chad Brackelsberg has been such a great director of the nonprofit, and side by side with the director of the Avalanche Center, with the Forest Service. You know, the Forest Service does all the forecasting. The nonprofit really takes care of the education, the outreach, the fundraising, the awareness, all that stuff. It's an army that nonprofit has really come on strong under Chad's leadership. Chad's also moving on to snowier pastures, and so we're in the last few weeks of trying to hire a new director for the nonprofit side, and Paige has worked for both the nonprofit and will be coming into the Forest Service, so she's going to have so much experience to be able to guide both directors, to the new chapter with us at the Utah Avalanche Center. So really looking forward to that, Leslie.
Okay, and then you guys have another week of active forecasting, and then wrapping things up Sunday?
Yeah, Sunday will be our last daily morning forecast across the state, and then we'll be issuing what we call intermittent updates as conditions warrant through the end of the month.
Okay. All right, Drew. Hey, thanks for the heads up.
Thanks so much. Yep.
Well, former and current Utah lawmakers are looking to lessons from the 2002 Winter Olympic Games as the state prepares for a potential 2034 Games. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
On Friday, officials who helped organize the 2002 Winter Olympic Games in Salt Lake City joined current lawmakers to discuss preparations needed if the Olympics return in 2034. The panel discussion was hosted by the Kem C. Gardner Institute and Deseret News and focused on learning from the past. Republican Senator Mitt Romney led the organizing committee for the 2002 Winter Olympics. Romney said hosting the Olympics was a massive undertaking, and it will be even more challenging for Utah to host them again. He said the two biggest areas of focus are transportation and security. During the 2002 games, he said Utah brought in 1,500 buses from across the country to transport people during the games, and transportation logistics overall was expensive. Security was also a big expense as costs increased after 9/11. By 2034, Romney said transportation and security will be even more expensive, and he recommended Utah officials start working on securing federal funds for the games now.
So that instead of asking for $3 or $4 billion down the road, we're able to get $200 or $300 million year after year going into special accounts.
Despite the challenges, Utah's former governor, Michael Levitt, said the state can benefit from the games both before and after the 17 days the worldwide event runs.
The value of the Olympics to the state is the 10 years in advance of the games, during which there is a huge amount of back pressure that will allow you to get a lot of things done that you could never get done in their absence.
Before the 2002 games, several infrastructure projects were undertaken, including constructing Park City's Old Town Transit Center, widening I-15, and installing the Trax light rail system in Salt Lake. With another Olympics on the horizon, projects like these could get another boost, and Park City and Summit County Council members are already thinking big about potential projects. The International Olympic Committee will announce a decision on Utah's bid for the 2034 Winter Games on July 24th. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Deputy Director Kendra Babbitts. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start first. We've seen a lot of this in the national news about the number of cases of measles that we're seeing nationwide. Is that an issue for Summit County?
It's not an issue currently. We don't have cases currently in Utah. However, we are very worried about getting cases here. So we're in the middle of spring break for many of our public schools, our universities, and a lot of those folks will be traveling to states that do have active outbreaks. So we are urging everyone to check their vaccination status. You can contact your healthcare provider. You can check the Docket app or go to immunize.utah.gov to see if you've been vaccinated and to seek that out if you're willing to do so. If you have not been vaccinated, that is the best protection against measles.
Yeah. What's so bad about measles? And the reason I ask is because I'm old enough now. I mean, I had measles, I had mumps, I had chicken pox. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, I know diseases kill, but at the same time, it also builds immunity.
Right. So diseases do kill. This is a disease that has that potential to kill, but also to have long-term disabilities. Those who are, like you say, if you had measles when you were younger, those born before 1957 are considered immune. But if you were born before 1957 and work in healthcare, that does not count. They still want you to get that extra dose of vaccination. Those who were vaccinated between 1963 and 1967, that vaccine was actually ineffective. So they are asking those folks to make sure that they are up to date on their vaccines there. So, for example, the current outbreak we're seeing in the country, 58% of those cases who are infected are hospitalized. And so we want to make sure that we are not causing additional strain on our healthcare system and making sure we're protecting ourselves and our communities as well.
Right, right. And there used to be a thing called German measles. I think the technical name is rubella. I'm not sure where the German measles came from.
No, I'm not actually sure either.
Yeah.
I'm not an epidemiologist, so that is not my background. But we're very grateful for the people at the health department like Nancy Porter and Derek Moss who have that information to provide to us.
Okay, and that the vaccination includes the measles, mumps, and rubella, right?
Correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a threefer. All right. I guess the health board also got an update on the public health accreditation process. So maybe talk to us about what this is and why Summit County's doing it.
So public health accreditation is basically a national recognition and standards that we are providing the essential public health services at the highest levels. So this is something that we're interested in attaining for many reasons, and it's not like it's going to be something new. A lot of this work we are already doing. So we're already providing services at the best of our capacity and capability. It's really having that note of recognition that will help us gain more notoriety in the community, help people feel trusted to come to us for services, and open additional doors for resources and funding.
So it's worth the time and money? I mean, I guess it's not costing you much other than staff time, huh?
Correct. So we just started those conversations with our Board of Health in the meeting last Monday, as well as our staff, to determine what that workload will look like, what the resources will look like to do that, and to see what timeline we want to pursue that. So that'll be something that we want to make sure everyone is in agreement with before moving forward.
Okay, so you have started the process then, or are you just looking for buy-in at this point?
We have started looking into the process. Mm-hmm. So at the Board of Health meeting last week, we had a lady from the Public Health Accreditation Board present to us on what that process may look like, what the work might involve, and then we will have continuing conversations with our staff to see if and when we're ready to pursue that.
Okay, and if you were to pursue it, how long does it take to get?
It can take up to 2 years, depending on readiness. There are different pathways you can go to achieve accreditation. They've added additional steps where if you feel like you're less prepared or want to take more time moving through the process, you can take as much time or as little time as you need.
All right. And is it something that's good forever, or is it good for 5 years? I mean, does it have to be renewed annually, or...?
It has to be renewed, and we would probably renew about every 5 years. And that's something that we would like to show that we can be able to do going forward.
All right. Let's see. The annual report by staff was also presented to the Health Board at their last meeting. What are some of the highlights of this?
So the annual report was very different format this year than we've done in the past, and we are very grateful for Derek Sidaway, the County Communication Director, as well as Isaac Cortez for putting this together. So this format, we decided to move towards our sustainability efforts and not have a printed version available, and also having a condensed version. So in previous years, we've had reports that were 70 plus, 90 plus pages detailing all of the efforts our department has done over the past year. Not only is that a lot of paper to use, but also a lot of folks don't take the time to read that. They probably don't care to see that much detail. So we created a one-pager, an infographic front and back that summarizes our budget, our revenues. It summarizes one highlight from 2023 that each program is most proud of. And we had them submit some photos as well. So it's pleasing to look at, it's easy to understand, and it's accessible on our website.
Okay. In terms of that, I mean, so really just the highlights, or was it a report that's saying, you know, this is where maybe we fell short and need improvement?
The handout itself was just the highlights, and then we encourage everyone to go to each individual program's webpage on our website to learn more about the details of those highlights or to see other areas that the program is working in.
Okay. So were there some need to improves, or?
There always needs to improve, but that's something that we're continually evaluating, and that's also something that we're excited to work with Public Health Accreditation on, is to help us find additional opportunities to improve.
All right. We also have a Hazardous Waste Disposal Day coming up. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is in partnership with our environmental health team led by Nate Brooks and Recycle Utah. The Hazardous Waste Disposal Day, the primary goal of that is to keep toxic chemicals and heavy metals out of our environment. We want to make sure that toxic materials like mercury, lead, pesticides, that if they end up in the landfill, they go into our groundwater. So that is our primary concern. So we are encouraging all Summit County residents to participate in that day and bringing anything that they are worried about disposing of to that location for proper disposal. So that includes things like paints, varnishes, solvents, motor oil, antifreeze, any type of batteries, gasoline, household cleaners, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, pool and spa chemicals, acids, propane, white gas fuel cylinders, compact fluorescent bulbs. Electronic waste is also included, like computers, monitors, TVs, cell phones, anything with mercury in it, pharmaceuticals, and even mattresses for a $20 fee there are included. So that will be at the Canyons Cabriolet parking lot Saturday, April 27th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And that, again, is just for Summit County residents and not for businesses, just for residents.
All right. Do you show a license or something? Is that what you need to do?
All they have told us is that they will be able to tell if you are a business.
Okay. And so the only cost then is for a mattress, huh?
Yes. And our health department, environmental health team, will be working with Recycle Utah to make sure motor oil and things like that are properly disposed of.
All right. And then we also have the health department offering free early intervention screenings for children up to 3 years old. So what kind of screenings are these?
So early intervention is a nationally run program that screens children 0 to 3 for developmental delays. So this could be from disabilities, this could be from environmental factors, but we know so much that interventions for children to make sure that they are reaching milestones for development before kindergarten are extremely important for success later in life. And so we offer free screenings through our health department staff. Jackie Greshick-Swan and her team run a wonderful program, and in fact they are repeatedly highlighted as one of the best in the state because they will go to the families and where the kids are to do screenings and provide therapeutic services. There is no other program in the state that does that, and that way it's the most comfortable place for the family and the children, and you can observe their behavior in their most natural, comfortable environment.
So what are you looking for? I mean, is it the, you know, speech, sitting up, rolling over? I mean,
all of those things, exactly. So we have physical therapists, speech pathologists who are looking for all of those milestones to make sure that we can be as prepared as possible for them to enter preschool and enter kindergarten.
So what would you find out? I mean, maybe a child has a hearing loss or perhaps a vision loss or something like that?
Yes, all of those things, or a physical disability, mental disabilities as well.
All right. So how do people get involved in that?
So they can either call our health department frontline, or they can visit our website at the Early Intervention Program. So our front desk number is 435-333-1500.
All right, and do you have people who can help maybe Spanish-speaking folks?
Absolutely. Yes, we have many Spanish-speaking staff who are available both at the front desk and through our community health workers and communications team who can help provide interpretation services.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Kendra?
No, this has been great. I appreciate your time today.
Okay. Thank you. Kendra Babbitts, again, the Deputy Director with the Summit County Health Department. Well, members of the Park City Council want to evaluate possible locations for a new city hall. KPCW's Parkamela Testa reports.
The Park City Council expressed interest in exploring new locations for City Hall during a discussion at its meeting Thursday. Councilmember Bill Sirocco said city employees are packed in tight working at the historic Marsack School in Old Town.
In the context of wanting to provide the best workplace for our staff here, I'd be inclined to have a conversation about the bigger picture and maybe what the future holds or should hold. In an effort to be as fiscally responsible as can be when we do this, I think we need to look at, you know, currently owned city inventory, city property, as a potential new site, wherever it may be. I feel like, you know, maybe we should move on this sooner rather than later. If we don't have enough space, where can we have enough space? And how can we make that happen?
Councilmember Jeremy Rubel agreed that the city should evaluate options. Rubel asked staff to analyze the cost of what a potential City Hall move could look like at different locations.
That could be helpful. And then, you know, from that choose your own adventure, we could say, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Or actually, yeah, let's explore that further.
Councilmember Tana Tully said she doesn't want the city to move out completely.
This is a very legacy building. There's a lot of emotion in the community about this building. And I just want to be very careful that we don't start on a conversation that starts with, we want to just move city staff out of here completely.
Councilmember Ed Parisian mentioned the Gordo property along State Route 248 and the Public Works building on Iron Horse Drive as potential sites. Parisian also asked to see price estimates.
This is a good time, I think, to make some big long-term moves here. So I'd like to see that discussion.
Separate from the search for a new home, the city is moving forward with two projects at City Hall, a gender-neutral restroom on the third floor and an ADA-compliant ramp in council chambers. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Youth Sports Alliance, I have Executive Director Emily Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with last week's celebration and community reveal. Sounds like a great turnout at Deer Valley.
Yeah, Deer Valley did a great job. They hosted us to have that community reveal of our Land Rover Defender. It was a great event. We had some local music by Nathan Spencer. We had Deer Valley's famous cookies and hot chocolate, and a bunch of people got to come out and see the new Land Rover. It was a really, really fun event, and excited to be able to show the community the new vehicle that will be transporting kids around for programs.
Okay, so you've got this... You haven't gotten to use it for transportation?
We are so close, but yes, so hopefully we will be able to use it in the upcoming weeks for our smaller programs, and then for our mountain bike programs, being able to transport bikes and kids or just bikes to a trailhead. So we have a garage full of mountain bikes and helmets, and for our scholarship students, we provide those bikes and helmets, but haven't been able to meet them at the trailhead with those bikes. So excited to use that.
Okay, and so this is what, going to be pulling a trailer with equipment?
Yeah, we're in the process of getting a trailer, potentially writing some grants for a trailer, but also getting, we're able to purchase a bike rack, so be able to rack 6 or 8 bikes. So excited to be able to do that and provide that for our program participants.
All right, and who gets to drive the thing?
Well, staff gets to drive the thing. We have been able to drive it now for, you know, any sort of work commitments, and it's great. People beep and wave and are very excited to see the vehicle. I know that in the community, we have some spirited discussions sometimes about which way the community should go, but I can't tell you how heartwarming this has been for the staff. Everywhere we go, people are telling us that they voted for us every day, and when it matters and when the community really cares about something, they show up. We were up against much bigger urban areas, and the fact that we were able to collect the most votes of anybody to win this vehicle is really a testament to this community and how much they care about youth and sport involvement.
Okay, so if we see it around town, we'll know it because it's you got it wrapped?
Yes, the Land Rover actually wrapped it for us. We worked with their design team, who were incredible, and you will definitely know it when you see it.
All right. Let's see. You've got registration open for programs now through the end of the school year. Tell us what you got.
Yeah, so we still have programs open. Registration is on our website at ysausa.org. They happen through the end of the school year, so lots of activities coming up: mountain biking, ice skating, Woodward indoor multi-sport, basketball, acting, a lot more. You can check out on our website. It's open to students from Park City, South Summit, North Summit, Wasatch School Districts, as well as Park City Day School, Telios Academy, Soldier Hollow Charter School, and homeschool can participate. So always check those out on our website. And also, just as a reminder, we do have two different levels of scholarships. So for those after-school programs, students eligible for the free and reduced lunch program pay a small commitment fee to participate. And then families making up to $120,000 a year annually can also request a scholarship. So those families just pay half the registration fee to participate. But we want to make sure that any family or student out there that wants to participate has the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. What do registration fees look like?
Well, gosh, it really varies from program to program. Alpine skiing is probably one of our, or the skiing program is probably higher, you know, somewhere between $200, $250 for a five-week program. And then, you know, some of our lower cost programs can be $50. So it's really a variety, but you can check them all out on ysausa.org.
So why is skiing so much?
Skiing, the transportation and just all of the pieces and parts, lift ticket lessons, getting all of those students there. But for our scholarship students, a five-week program, we provide the equipment, we provide the clothing, helmet, goggles, gloves, lift ticket, lesson, and transportation, and we ask them to pay $10 a week, so just $50 for that Learn to Ski program. So it really is an affordable way to get out and get your student learning something new.
All right. Let's see. You've also got a survey out asking people what?
Yeah, so we're sort of actively exploring some new ways to look at how we can get some students out and active after school. We have heard sort of continuous feedback over the last couple of years about students 6th to 12th grade who are not selected for high school sport teams. So that's a really challenging thing. A lot of the sport teams in Park City are quite competitive, so students need to be playing club before they try out for those teams in that high school years. And so I think it's been pretty devastating for kids not to be selected for teams. And this is happening all across the Wasatch back. And so looking to see if there's an interest for lack of a better word, an intramural league across the Wasatch back with the four high schools, looking at potentially non-traditional sports, flag football, pickleball, ultimate frisbee, bowling, you know, who knows, badminton, and seeing if that's something of interest to students and seeing if we can sort of solve that problem. It's just sort of heartbreaking to think about kids across the Wasatch back not being selected and then not having something to do after school. So we have a survey out there. We would love to have as many people answer that survey as possible so we can sort of figure out what is the best direction. So that is on our Facebook page, which is Youth Sports Alliance. It's also on our Instagram. And then hopefully we'll have it up on our website slider here soon.
All right. And when do people have until to fill that survey out? Is there a deadline?
Yeah, deadline is, you know, in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. It would be great to get as many people to filling that out as possible. Sort of in this time period before the next fiscal year starts and before summer, when we do a lot of our planning and plotting for the next year, we would love to just see if this is something that has legs and, you know, potentially can be something that we get involved in. We've spoken with Principal Arbabi and Jamie Sheets at the high school. They're both supportive of looking into this and seeing this if this is a problem that we can solve as in partnership and as a community.
Yeah, so your fiscal year starts when?
It starts May 1, but sort of we're just in the process of looking at all of those pieces and parts. And like I said, we're just doing some exploratory looking at this. It's something that's repetitively been brought up, as I said, across the Wasatch Back, not just Park City, that just trying to see if there's a way we can offer more opportunities to give kids something outside, active, off their screens after school.
Okay, and this could start, what, as soon as next school year? Is that the thing?
You know, I think next school year, next fall would be pretty aggressive. I think it's probably something that we look into and see if we could launch maybe next spring, something like that. But yeah, we're just sort of looking into those options and seeing how we can help keep kids active.
Yeah. So is it possible, though, to have some kind of traditional sports? I mean, the lacrosses and soccers and basketball and baseball programs as well? Or
I don't know. We'll have to see what the desire is for the community. If a student isn't selected for one of those teams, do they want to keep playing that sport in a different way? There are some very strong club programs out there. Sometimes they can't operate during that season. So looking into all of those parts, I know you can't play high school and club at the same time. So some of those clubs don't operate during that season. So just looking and seeing if, you know, maybe a student is tired of the sport they've been playing, but it transfers well into sports like ultimate frisbee or flag football. Is that an option for them?
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope, that's it. Just have a great spring and happy spring break, everybody.
Okay. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Emily Fisher is the executive director of the Youth Sports Alliance. Rocky Mountain Power is cutting electricity from Silver Creek to Tollgate on Wednesday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the outage could affect up to 1,000 Summit County residents.
The 10-hour planned outage covers all of service area number 3 in Silver Creek, all of Tollgate Canyon, and all of Red Hawk Ranch. It does not include East Creek Ranch. The reason for the temporary shutdown is that Rocky Mountain Power is moving power lines along Mammoth Drive, a future road connecting Silver Creek Estates to Bittner Ranch Road, set for completion this year. Rocky Mountain will cut power at 8 a.m. Wednesday and restore it at 6 p.m. Company spokesperson David Eskelson says the outage is needed to ensure the safety of the repair crew, and he said it's not an unusual duration of time for this kind of work. According to Eskelson, Rocky Mountain first began notifying affected customers April 3rd. The power company recommends stocking up on non-perishables, battery-powered electronics, blankets, and water to prepare for an outage. Highs will be in the 40s or 50s Wednesday. Maps of the outage area are available at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, National Library Week is here, and Summit County Libraries have plans to celebrate. KPCW's Christine Weller has details.
National Library Week is April 7th to 13th, and Summit County's Kimball Junction, Camas Valley, and Colville Library branches invite the community to show their library spirit. Dan Compton, the library director at the Kimball Junction branch, said this is the second year Summit County Libraries have held a Spirit Week to celebrate. The week starts with Wear a Hat Monday and Crazy Socks Tuesday. Then it's Wacky Wednesday, where librarians have wacky hair or clothes.
It was funny because last year that was Wacky Wednesday and we were all dressed up in crazy things. And then we actually were presenting to the county council and we just decided to go in wearing all of our funny clothes.
On Throwback Thursday, librarians wear something from a different decade. The last day of the Spirit Week is Bookish Friday, where librarians dress up as their favorite book character or wear a book-themed shirt. Those who join librarians in dressing up can visit a Summit County branch for a treat. Participating in the Spirit Week is a great way for locals to show appreciation for all libraries do to support the community. Compton said Summit County Libraries circulated almost 302,000 physical materials and almost 109,000 digital materials in 2023. Nearly 2,000 new borrowers were also added to the system. Compton said there are also free learning opportunities for toddlers all the way to seniors. On top of that, Compton said libraries are also safe places locals can hang out in.
There aren't many places nowadays you can go without being expected to pay money for something, and the library is one of those last places where you can just go and be and pursue your interests, whatever you'd like to learn about, in a safe space.
Compton said anyone who lives or works in Summit County can get a free library card at a local branch. All that's needed is a photo ID. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, Matthew Prince has filed a second civil lawsuit against his next-door neighbors who are appealing the tech billionaire's plans to build a new home on Treasure Hill. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Prince says a rock wall crosses the property line between the lot he bought in March and the lot next door, which belongs to Eric and Susan Herman. The Cloudflare CEO filed the lawsuit Friday, claiming the wall illegally encroaches on his property. Last month, Prince sued the Hermans over the behavior of their Bernese Mountain Dogs on a Treasure Hill trail, which is adjacent to both their homes. Attorney Bruce Baird, who represents Prince, called the rock wall lawsuit a simple property dispute. But Eric Herman claims the two lawsuits are an act of retaliation. The Hermans and eight other neighbors have appealed the construction plans for Prince's proposed home overlooking Old Town. Herman said the rock wall hasn't been touched since he and his wife moved into their home in 2006. He claims the alleged encroachment is several inches wide and stretches around 6 feet. Herman said in a statement, quote, "The level of harassment we are now experiencing is astonishing." The neighborhood appeal of Prince's home is set for review by Park City's three-member appeal panel on April 30th. Matthew Prince and his wife Tatiana own the park record. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Park City Education Foundation, I have the Vice President of Advancement, Jennifer Bellow. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's just start with a quick background of what the Education Foundation is and what your mission is.
Yeah, so we fund and support educator-powered initiatives that inspire all Park City students to reach their academic and lifelong potential. We've been doing this since 1986, so nearly 40 years. And every year we infuse at least $1.5 million into the Park City School District through eight signature initiatives, and those are preschool, elementary visual arts, after school, educator and student wellness, real world learning, Bright Futures, Classroom and Express Grants, and our Innovation Lab.
All right, and that money comes from where?
It comes from our community donors. It comes from our events. It comes from private donors, foundations. It's all donors. Every single dollar is raised by donations.
Okay, and I guess what's so great about this is that it ensures that the money raised here stays here, unlike the property taxes.
Yeah, our state income taxes that fund education, we send all of ours down, and because of equalization, we get almost none back. So about $150 million of our taxes go down and gets redistributed to the state. So we get to support the Park City School District in initiatives that are a lot of people might think are necessary or would be paid for locally, but they can't be. So that's where we come in.
All right. Let's talk about one of the programs that you do help support. That's the Innovation Lab and Classroom Grants. I think last time we talked about the applications for those grants.
Yeah, so those were all due on April 1st, Classroom Grants, and that's our oldest program. That's how we started in 1986, was with a grant to a teacher. I think Kara gave a report, our program's vice president, we had 44 requests for $440,000. I think we have about $250,000 to distribute, so the Classroom Grant Committee will have some tough decisions to make. And that part of the Innovation Lab, what we're talking about this month, that initiative, what we realized as we were going along is that we weren't infusing educator voice as much as we should have been into our programming. So really, teachers are our end user. The students are the beneficiaries, but the teachers are the end user. And most of our decisions were being made by community members, but not a lot of educators, and they really have the expertise. So starting in 2016, we started the Teacher Voice Project, where we met with teachers once a quarter to talk about what would make their job easier or better, and that morphed into the Innovation Lab. And so from that, we now have four educators on our board of directors. Our Classroom Grant Committee is majority made up of educators, as well as some students. And then we also, every other year, we do Ideas for Impact, where we bring together educators. We kind of put on a conference science fair where the local educators talk about what is succeeding in their classroom, and hopefully those ideas will spread to other classrooms. Because that was one of the things that came out of the Innovation Lab, is teachers were like, you know, we don't always hear what's going on in other schools in our district, in our own district, or even other classrooms, especially after COVID, where things were so shut down and closed off for a while. Now bringing everybody together is really important to convene those ideas. And so we do that every other year, so we'll be doing that next year. But we're still, there are the ideas that came out of last year are happening across the district. One of them is the Kindergarten Academy. So at Jeremy Ranch, a teacher had started a Kindergarten Academy where for the first week, kids actually weren't assigned a teacher, and the teachers kind of watched what kids did as they went through different projects, different activities, different tables, and then they could get to know the kids better, divide up classes so there was a great mix of kids in each class, and then every teacher was a little more aware of their kids' strengths and challenges. And that idea has spread to all four kindergartens across the district, all four schools, and they love it. Yeah, it's been great.
So if a teacher is on this committee, what, do they recuse themselves if they should have a grant?
Yes, that it hasn't happened yet, but it's new enough that it absolutely could. And yes, so they would leave the room and not be part of that discussion of that grant.
Okay. Let's see. Coming up, you are planning the Excellent Educator Program. This usually happens this time of year.
It does. So this is another way we try to support teachers and the profession across the district. So this is probably our second oldest program. The Excellent Educator Award started in 1986. They were started by Jim Doylney, who's a local resident for many, many years. His mother was a teacher. And so every school votes on the person in their building that they think best exemplifies an excellent educator. So it's a totally open nomination. And then the recipients are surprised with the award. So after COVID, we weren't doing them all in one day as we had done in the past because of protocols. It seems hard to think about these protocols now where we couldn't do big gatherings. But last year, the principal said, we want to do it all back on one day. And then the Lewis family has also joined in with the Doylneys. So Hank Lewis, both families came to Park City in the 70s. Hank and Jim both have grandkids in the district now, both huge believers in education. Hank himself has been a teacher. And so we, on April 26th, Friday, April 26th, we'll go around to all the schools and surprise the recipient with a reveal. And each school, their celebration is unique to that school. But typically there's an assembly or we'll go to the classroom. We bring the band with us, so we march in with the band. And it's just a great surprise. And people, the teachers, that they're so overwhelmed. There's just tears of joy and it really is just one of those great days. And we also honor every single educator with a free entry to Running with Ed. So what every single winner without fail is in the 12 or 13 years I've been doing this has said, I'm just one teacher or, a lunch lady can win, custodian can win. I'm just one person that's putting on a great education for our students. It really is teamwork. And so taking that to heart, the award has grown. And so now, any educator who wants to run in the race, it's a Park City School District, can get free entry to Running with Ed. We also send everybody a caramel apple from Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. And so it really is just this big celebration of the profession overall.
Okay, so have those nominations already been submitted?
They have, yes. Okay. So I do know the winners, but I can't tell because it is a surprise. It's so fun to see that every year. And a lot of times the winners are teachers who have been asking for grants for every year. So they're really trying to do the things that make their classroom sing for their students and really try to enrich that learning experience. And then there's also the Sarah and Stephen Doylney Award, and that is the award voted on by the senior class every year for the educator who has been most influential over their entire career. And so typically it's a high school teacher that wins that, but you will always see at least one kindergarten teacher voted in there, which is really meaningful. And then all the comments, the teachers and all the educators can write comments on their form, and we send those out to every teacher. So even if you didn't win the award, you might read a comment about yourself from a senior or a fellow educator, and it's really inspiring.
All right. So when will the teachers be honored? When's that set for?
On April 26th, okay. And we will start at the high school at 7:45. And we tour all the schools. So we'll put that schedule up on our website so people can tour along if they want as well.
Well, certainly it's an honor, but I think they also get some prize money, yeah?
Yes, so that is part of the award that's funded by the Doylenys and the Lewises. So everybody gets cash award, which is, nice to have that extra money for sure. And then there's the plaque that gets your name inscribed on it. And of course, that goes up in the hallways, and they all go back to 1996, except for Ecker and Trailside, because they weren't around yet in 1996.
Okay, and then finally, registration for Running with Ed, still taking applications?
Yeah, we're in regular registration now, so we're already almost at 500 registrants, and so we encourage everyone to register as soon as possible. You know you're going to do it. It's the most fun day of the year, of the spring, and we've got swag bags, we have t-shirts. The first 1,000 people will get a special edition t-shirt. It's our 15th anniversary, which seems hard to believe. I'm already hearing about some great team names, great costumes, running from our kids. There's a million different versions of Running with Ed and running with Dread, all those kinds of fun names. And so we, this is what pays for those classroom grants. So your money that you're raising, whether through your registration fee or doing team fundraising, is going to go right back into the classroom the next year. So we encourage all the community, whether you have kids or not, if you have a business, it is a great day of employee engagement. So I know one CEO told me, I can be with a whole variety of staff, whether you're a runner or not, because they're such easy legs, or they're just the driver. And we have 5 hours of just fun, cheering, laughing, hugging, being silly, eating chocolate strawberries. It's a really great day of employee bonding. So I would encourage any business, if you haven't done the race before, it's a very reasonable, it's $125 a person day of employee engagement.
Okay, anything else, Jen, you want to mention?
We had our Bright Futures, our second college graduation celebration on Saturday. 7 college graduates from the Bright Futures program. It was a night, I think I cried the whole night long, so all their families come and get this very special dinner that's put on by Alora Catering. And the families get to talk about what this means to them and their students. One girl said, I come from nothing and I'm going to be a doctor. Another parent said he was so proud of his son. We had to flee. And now my son is a college graduate and no one can take that away from him. It just was a remarkable evening. And I really want to, I'm going to start getting overclamped. I want to thank the community for their support of that program.
Okay, Jen, thanks.
Thank you.
Jennifer Billow is the Vice President of Advancement for the Park City Education Foundation. Well, the Utah Office of Outdoor Education is working on e-bike rules and increasing trail connections. KPCW's Christine Muller has more.
Utah's outdoor recreation economy had record-breaking growth in 2022, and it's still growing. The Utah Office of Outdoor Recreation was created in 2022 to accommodate that growth and is now working on e-bike regulations and trail designs. Tara McKee is the Deputy Director of Grants and Planning at the Outdoor Recreation Office. She says e-bikes are a hot topic every year. To keep trails safe, the office has to think about making and enforcing rules and educating riders. However, McKee said it's hard to police which bikes are allowed on trails because the line between e-bikes and motorbikes is becoming increasingly blurred.
We do have continuing need to be looking at and staying ahead of the technology on the e-bikes, so that people aren't getting used to taking something that's very close to the capacities of a lightweight motorcycle out on the trails that are meant to be non-motorized.
That means the office has to look at how all types of bikes are geared and how fast they go. Adaptive e-bikes for people with disabilities are also part of the equation. McKee said e-bike technology has made trails more accessible for adaptive riders, and the office wants to create a good experience for them, too.
Are the trails needing tweaks to make it possible for them to enjoy those trails as they go out with their families and friends?
Park City and the Snyderville Basin Recreation District have also been working on e-bike regulations as they have different rules regarding e-bikes. The two entities are working on creating consistent rules. The Outdoor Recreation Office is also working on creating a trail network crossing state lines. McKee says they are looking to model trails after the Continental Divide Trail, which spans from Canada to Mexico.
Most of that infrastructure already exists, and there's opportunities to just make some connections or solve some of the issues that might make doing those trails difficult, such as access to water.
Utah's outdoor recreation team will meet with recreation departments from Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming May 13th to 15th to discuss trail connections. The Mountain West Trails Conference will be in Vernal, Utah. Christine Weller, KPCW News.